This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Jimmy hit Austin.
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
I've been warped by the rain and driven by the snow. I'm drunk and dirty, don't you know, but I'm still willing.
Yeah, I was out on the road late last night. Saw my Alice in every headlight. Alice, Dallas, Alice. I've been from Tucson to Tucumcari.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It's Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, coming to you from Trinidad World Recording Studios here in beautiful Fort Worth, Texas. Well, 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 my friends, I'm still shaking after last week's episode. I mean, we were out there, as we do on the podcast, adrift in the fog, looking for some guiding light. We came to last week. The light was there in the fog in the form of my good friend Kurt South, who joins us today. How you doing, South?
I'm wonderful, Phil. How are you today?
I'm doing all right. I'm still thinking about our topic last week about your album. I couldn't tell if I was talking you out of it, talking you into it. Just you, the black and white photo. You, who every album has been a beard album, a journey from some horrid depth.
Some dark place.
Oh, we got a lot of feedback on that. Thanks for your emails. A lot of people just disconcerted over the whole deal. South on the bathroom floor, you know, sprawled out, black and white photo. But
I didn't realize
a great record.
I didn't realize so many people cared at that point.
It's good to know, isn't it? It's comforting.
People concerned about my well-being and personal health.
That's right. Well, we've gotten a lot of emails. Our second segment, as we like to do a lot, is address some viewer mail. Gotten some all kinds of emails from people all over the country. Thank you so much. I find people outside of Texas really listen a lot. We get a lot of places from a lot of places. You're like, gosh, who's this guy listening out there in Ann Arbor, Michigan, or Kansas City, Missouri, Denver, Colorado, places like that. Thank you so much for emails. I read every single one. Phil at philpritchett.com. Email us. Call us 817-733-5256. Come record at Trinidad or book Phil Pritchett and the full band. Well, we got our three segments lined up here, South. I'm very excited about our show today. In our first segment, we're going to look at an evolution of the business. We kind of allude to a lot on this show, talking about new music and challenges facing the new musician. We, you know, kind of offhandedly say, the labels don't care anymore, you know, corporate stuff, whatever, sucks, whatever. Why is that? We're going to go back and just kind of give you sort of a music economic lesson to some degree about kind of who some of these labels were, how they got started, how we got to where we are now, and sort of how the landscape has changed here over the last several years. Give you guys out there making records and playing shows and recording music in your house some perspective on what you're up against a little bit. Then our second segment, as I mentioned, we'll get into some viewer mail. Then we're going to get some Heartland Rock and Roll in the vault, Kurt. Who we got over there?
Looking forward to it. Little Mellencamp.
Johnny Cougar, man, as he hates to be called.
Scarecrow.
What a great album when this came out, man. In the vault, we're going to get into a Johnny Cougar Mellencamp. Scarecrow.
Maybe I'll do an acoustic version of Rain on the Scarecrow for you. On the 12th
Blood
string.
On the Plow. Well, our first segment here has to do with the label, the evolution of the music business from a label's perspective. Now, back in the 40s, 30s, 40s, recorded music was being made. He had someone who had literally had the microphones, the could press the 78s, press the 33s, the LPs, and sell them in some way. I mean, Sam Phillips in Memphis, famously mm-hmm. Sun Records, I think a lot of our viewers would be maybe most familiar with. You know, he had an office with a studio in the back, and you paid him to record. Then I guess if you were good, if you were whoever he had.
He'd put you on his label.
Carl Perkins, Jerry Lee Lewis, Elvis Presley, Johnny Cash, et al. He'd say, hey, we're going to press some 45s. But he would just walk outside of his building with a box of records and sell them for 10 cents or something like that and get people listening and play it on the radio. And that was the record business. And to some extent, it was the same way. All the way through really almost getting into like the mid-80s, mm-hmm. you still had these pioneer-type guys like Phillips. You had Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss.
David Geffen.
You had Ahmet Erdogan, who started Atlantic Records.
Geldof at Island.
And all these guys who were just a single human being with his own money, his own passion, signing acts that he liked. And yes, he'd get distribution and radio play and things, but the buck stopped there, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, if Ahmet Erdogan and Atlantic Records didn't like you, you didn't have a chance. He wasn't answering to anybody. The decision started and stopped with him. So if he liked Ray Charles, or he liked Led Zeppelin, or he liked Aretha Franklin, and said, man, I'm gonna put this stuff out here, I think it's great. The label was an artist in and of itself. I mean, you had to be able to have a lot of passion, a lot of vision. That was a requirement back in starting out in all these guys. Would you agree, South?
Yeah, definitely. The guy, as you said, the buck stopped with him, and it was his baby. It was his, you know, he didn't write songs. He sold music, and he helped create it as far as getting it recorded and putting it on vinyl. That was his role in the whole thing. He was the purveyor of the artist's material, I guess. And, you know, when Elvis went to Columbia Records, Columbia just bought Elvis from Sam Phillips.
What was it, $100,000 or something?
Yeah.
Something like that?
Yeah, it was like selling
$80,000
or something? Selling a used car, you know, almost.
That's right. Well, they were the talent was assets, was an asset to the label.
Yeah.
The higher quality the talent, the guy could really sing and dance. People came to his shows, bought his records. The higher the value of the asset.
Right.
That's a good example to kind of start with Phillips, because he did sell Elvis mm-hmm. and the rights to record Elvis's music.
Sold Johnny Cash eventually.
Sold Johnny Cash. Sold everybody.
Yeah.
It's the American way, as they say. You build something of value, you sell. And I guess that starts to come to my point a little bit. I'm always amazed. A&M Records mm-hmm. Stands for Alpert and Moss. You had Herb Alpert and Jerry Moss. Alpert, who was a noted Tijuana Brass. Was he the trumpet player?
Trumpet player.
Jazz, yeah.
Yeah.
Herb Alpert, just a music guy, a real music guy. Gosh, you look back, man, the Police. Fairport Convention was on A&M. Who's some of those A&M? Sheryl Crow late in the game. Discovered her.
I mean, they were huge.
Cat Stevens, I think, was A&M.
They had tons of huge acts.
Tons of huge acts. But the same deal, though. They had a building, a studio. The buck stopped with those guys. They were the decision makers. They knew music. They knew their artists. And knew how to use what they had. Of course, what happens is, eventually, as music sales, especially in the 80s, just started going way up, getting into the 90s, and all along the way, like any business that works, that is successful, that makes a lot of money, it's going to attract the attention of businessmen, the business side of things, corporate. I'm not saying that, you know, Jerry Moss and Ahmet Erdogan certainly wanted to make money, of course, but they did love music,
right?
First and foremost, what you start running up against was Ahmet Erdogan. He makes a couple million a year running Atlantic. You know, Sony or whoever comes to him and says, hey, we want to buy your catalog. And he says, well, it's not for sale. I make $2 million a year. And they say, well, we'll write you a check today for $300 million to walk away. I guess eventually, if you really look back, they've all sold.
They all took the check.
They all took the check. And when you hear people today talk about there's really only three major record labels, that you got Sony, you have
Universal Music Group,
which is Bertelsmann, right? Isn't that Germany, the Germans own on that?
Yeah, I think they do.
And then you have Warner, Time Warner, in the America. Warner's the only American-based corporate.
Yeah.
But those are the big things. And those corporations are run by business guys.
And they all have, all those three companies have numerous labels, imprints underneath
their
name.
They do.
Like Mercury Records is part of Universal Records. Universal South is part of...
Oh, there's a million labels out there.
So they're all under three umbrellas,
but
basically.
This goes to my point. When you, as a guy, are in Nashville or wherever you're going, hey, man, we got a meeting with the head of Columbia, or we got a meeting with the head of whoever, some label... You're not talking to Ahmed Erdogan. You're not talking to a guy where the buck stops.
No.
A guy who's got his own money invested, his own passion invested. That doesn't mean the guy doesn't like music and is not good at business. But that guy is getting a paycheck every month from Tokyo or Sony or whatever is under his umbrella. Mm-hmm. He needs to keep his job.
Right.
Right? And if he sticks his neck out for you and your music and it doesn't work, He's at risk of losing his job.
And he has one chance. You to be a hit. And if you're not, you're gone.
That's it. You can't go to bat for something. Erdogan, he would keep believing in Aretha Franklin, Ray Charles. And we may now say, well, duh, it was obvious that they were just so great.
But it took years.
It was a tough sell, man.
Yeah.
You had a blind piano player, Ray Charles.
Mm-hmm.
You know. A black man out there in the world, you know, making music for a white audience kind of thing. Very difficult. A lot stacked against you. He wanted to make gospel. He wanted to make country and western albums. Very difficult sell. Mm-hmm. And so if it was a loser maybe early on, or it took a while to convince people, Erdogan alone with his money and passion would push it through. And that was a big component in making these guys who they were eventually.
And it didn't matter to him. There was nobody to please above him, so... He would put as much time and money into it as he wanted.
No one was
going to
fire Ahmed Erdogan.
Right.
And so I think that people say, man, I met a thing with the president of this label or something. You always got to know where the family tree is. Just go, mm-hmm. wait a minute. Because, man, more often than not, and I ran into this in Nashville so often, I'd have some quote-unquote meeting with some guy. Oh, he's the A&R guy. He's the head of the label. You go in there, and he's sitting in an office with a stack of CDs on his desk, and he's got a putter in the corner. And a pencil on his desk. He's just kind of sitting there. And you're like, wait, you know, what? How'd you get here? Well, you know, I used to work in the tape room, you know, and I knew this guy, so I got hired. And here he is. But this isn't a guy who's been out hustling for bands. You know what I'm saying? It's just, it's a job.
He may not even like music.
He's just being nice to me because, I don't know, that's his job. I don't know, but I keep trying, so I'd play my songs and try to win this guy over, but he's not the decision maker, even though he may be the vice president of some label or something. He can't get anything done, and he's not going to stick his neck out for you.
No.
He can't. So what I want these young bands to know is you got to know what the family tree is. Now, there are independent labels out there with some decision maker out there that can make waves.
In fact, they're a larger segment of what music
large,
that's
right.
being sold
you think,
than the majors.
Right, right, they may have major distribution, but they don't take orders from somebody else. So you do you do have the possibility to have a, like I'm thinking like a Merge Records, I think. You know,
there's a Merge, New
tons.
West,
right? New West is one that have major distribution and stuff. But there is a guy who started the business and acquires acts he thinks are going to be assets to what he's got going on.
Until somebody offers him enough
money.
Until
somebody, so and right, he someone goes to New West and says, man, we want this catalog. Well, I don't know, man. I'll make $1 million a year. Look, we'll give you 10.
Yeah.
Goodbye. So what happens is, over since the 40s, you have had through, and I'm not saying this is bad, okay? I'm not saying these guys have shorted the American public or anything like that. But the reality is these guys, one by one, Moss, John Hammond, Ahmed Erdogan, guys who were visionaries, who started music, Sam Phillips, and found these acts and passionately produced them and sold them, which was a big part of it. How one by one cashed out and went away. Mm-hmm. Obviously couldn't compete with who bought them out. There's always like a non-compete clause. They couldn't get started on the label the next day.
Right.
And one by one, these guys got out of the marketplace. And also, there was not a whole lot of guys coming underneath them.
No.
With the, you know, that... then you got people going into the business specifically to make the money. Hey, man, I just want to sell to some other guy. So what you ended up with here is it's like the Monopoly board, and you got three guys who own all the properties. You got Warner, Bertelsmann, and Sony. Mm-hmm. And you're like, hey, how come there's not a lot of great music being made at the major label? And you just go, it just simply can't happen, man. You don't have a...
they're trying to produce music the way... Nike produces shoes.
Yeah,
come out with some styles.
The guys who run these corporations, they're businessmen. They just acquired the assets. All people want to buy this guy. They didn't know who. They may not have known a whole lot about Led Zeppelin or Ray Charles. They just knew that there were millions of dollars coming in on their albums. They acquire that asset. That's it. Like, who else are they signing now? Who are they out watching? Or they may hire guys to quote unquote run the label. They're still taking orders from somebody. And when you have that sort of atmosphere in any business, you're going to struggle. You know, you're going to struggle.
And here's the main difference between
innovation. You know,
yeah. And here's the main difference nowadays with the way that people are signed to labels. A major label isn't going to want you unless you already are a proven commodity. Unless you've already done a lot on your own. Which then
they still want to buy a proven asset.
Right.
They don't want to develop something from scratch.
Right. Which you could argue, if you're already doing well on your own, do you need the major label?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas back in the 60s, Ahmet Erdogan might have seen you playing in a club and there was no one there, but he really thought and really believed that he could sell what you were doing.
Right.
And he could take and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars and half a decade making you into a star.
Yeah.
And now they don't do that. Now they just you'll sit down at a table with a guy from a big label, and he'll go, "So how many records have you sold independently, and what's your touring revenue like?" That's the first thing he wants to know, because he's looking. It's a merger and an acquisition.
That's
just like if you owned any other kind of business.
Right.
So they're looking to merge your business with theirs, and acquire your catalog, and see if they can take it and grow it even more.
That's right.
So it's not a question of, man, this guy's better than that one. This guy, it's all numbers. It's all business.
Right. And to some degree, you know, it is a business, always has been a business. But there is no denying the musical passion of an Ahmet Erdogan or the musical skill as a trumpet player of a Herb Alpert, a well-known guy in his own right. Mm-hmm. You did have musicians running these things. It kind of be like, if this might be a silly example, but the NFL, you know, you have 30 teams out there. If somehow they all sold to the same two or three owners, one owner kind of owned the whole NFC West, you know, like four or five teams and none of the teams do very well. And the guy that bought it you don't have any football guys running those, you know. I mean, Jerry Jones is passionate about the Dallas Cowboys, you know. And you have stuff like that. But if that kind of went away, and, you know, sure, Jerry is football owners are going to be business-minded, of course. But they're also passionate about the team. They want to win, and they hire people, GMs and things like that, who know a lot about the game. But if you did end up having all the teams under one roof, like under, you know, the whole AFC was owned by one guy, I think the quality of play and everything would just start to kind of fall by the wayside. It wouldn't be as good.
Everything, that's what's cool about the NFL, is you have Danny Snyder owns the Redskins.
Right.
And he's this figure and this character on his own, just like Jerry Jones is, just like Al Davis
That's how the labels used to be.
Cool. Yeah, but
you're not
now
gonna, Al Davis. He's got to approve everything with his owners. No, he's the guy. He is the Oakland Raiders, and if he's good or bad, it's on his deal and his draft picks and all that reflects his personality.
And that's been lost in music. That can kind of give you the idea of why mainstream music is so homogenized now, because there's three people making all the decisions.
That's basically right. And you might say, oh, but they own all kinds of labels. I'm like, I know, but they're all getting a paycheck from the president of Sony, the board, or whatever.
But the thing is to remember is there are still numerous labels out there run by musicians.
Sure.
A good example is ATO Records, which is a very big independent
label.
Dave Matthews.
They've got Ben Queller, David Gray, acts like that.
Yeah, Government Mule, yeah. Warren Haynes, Dave Matthews and Corin Capshaw, his manager. Merge Records is owned by the guy who's the lead guitarist and singer for Superchunk.
Is that right? I didn't know that.
Yeah, so, you know, he's an indie rock guy his whole life, and in North Carolina, he started Merge Records, which is a huge independent label.
Yeah, that's right. Spoon, so many others.
Yeah, so it still exists the way it did years ago. I think it's just important for people to realize what's the difference between John Hiatt being on New West and John Hiatt being on Columbia.
Exactly. That's kind of the point of our segment.
Right. That's the difference right there. The music business is fine. It's just changed. It's important to realize that. I mean, I get a little uncomfortable with, man, the music business is in the crapper, is it? Yeah. No, it's just different. It's the landscape has changed dramatically. And if you know how it's changed and you understand those differences, then you can kind of – you got to know who's selling to you.
You got to know who you're talking to in the meeting. Yeah. You just say, man, I'm talking to the most important guy here at the label.
Right.
And, man, he just – you know, he just worked his way up and – He's not going to do anything to lose his job, you know?
You can walk into Frank Liddell's office at Carnival Records in Nashville and know that that you're talking to the guy.
You're on your way.
Yeah. But you can walk down the street to the Mercury Records office and you're never going to see a decision maker because one doesn't exist. Luke Lewis is there somewhere hovering in the background.
Right.
And maybe
he's working for a corporation.
But he's working for, exactly. So it's completely different in that way.
Right.
And, the major labels in the 60s weren't major labels. They were just labels.
They were just little businesses. They were little businesses.
I don't even like that term major labels because what does it mean anymore? They're just record labels out there.
Yeah.
Some of them are owned by corporate conglomerates.
Owners of musical assets, I guess.
Yeah. And some of them are owned by one guy in a garage in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
That's right.
Well,
there's some label talk for you. You go have that big meeting with somebody in L.A. or New York. Know who you're talking to. Know what that family tree looks like. Are you talking to the decision maker, the guy that owns it, the decision maker? Then that's a meeting worth going to. If you're just talking to some quote-unquote A&R guy for Columbia, don't waste your freaking time.
A&R is...
No A&R.
A&R is code for guy who gets coffee when the guy from corporate comes into
that's
town.
Right. Whereas Ahmed Erdogan would have real A&R guys whose musical judgment he trusted,
right?
Who would call him, hey, I'm in some club up here in
they were his
Dayton,
ears
Ohio,
on the street.
Dude. That you got to see these guys.
This guy Pritchett's up here playing a guitar solo with a drumstick.
Playing with a drumstick. I'll get on a plane and we'll see him play in New York in 3 nights. And there they'd come and sign me and swoop me away. I'd go on tour with Zeppelin. That's what would have happened, man, in the 60s. Oh, we're all born decades too late, South. It's a shame, isn't it? Well, our next segment here. We're going to get into some of your viewer mail, your questions, your concerns. Thanks for emailing in, Phil at philippritchard.com. Viewer mail, the ever-expanding viewer mailbag when we get back.
I've been kicked by the wind and robbed by the sleet. Had my head stoved in, but I'm still on my feet. And I'm still... Yeah, I smuggle some smokes and folks from Mexico. Baked by the sun every time I go to Mexico. Down in Mexico.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. Phil Pritchard here on the P2 Podcast. From Trinidad World Recording Studios here in Fort Worth, Texas. It's a beautiful day here in Fort Worth. Rainy, night getting a little cool, fall starting to come in. Kurt South is here with me.
It is not getting cool.
Yeah, a little bit today.
It's just
today.
Not 98.
It's just not 98, but that's cool for us here in North Texas,
yes,
man.
It is.
Beating the heat. I'm sick. Relishing in the rain.
I am beating the high holy hell by it.
You've said that the last few weeks, man, on the podcast. Just
killing
me. Heat killing you. Oh, man, we're talking about some label talk here. Well, let's get into some viewer mail. We've been getting a lot of viewer mail. Always. We always try to shoot you back. Thanks for listening. We really do appreciate it. We read everyone. Phil at philpritchard.com. Well, Kurt, you had a laundry list of questions from... who'd that come from over there?
From Kat in Arlington, Texas.
You know, she's been on the show before, hasn't she?
Yes. Kat is at almost every show. She is a wonderful, wonderful person. A fine follower. And she has some good questions. And the first one was directed at you, P2.
Me?
At
Why
you.
Did she email me directly? She emailed this to you?
She likes me better.
I got you.
Just a little.
Oh, Kat, Phil at philpritchard.com. Listen to the show.
Phil, what is the deal with the denim shirt and jacket and scarf?
You're making that up. You're making that up. Although no, we did address that in a viewer mail a few weeks back. It was 104. You were wearing three coats.
You and South were walking along the beach dressed in just full gear.
A couple of cowboys roaming loose in North Carolina.
Are y'all really gay or do you just not feel heat?
Like a scene out of Midnight Cowboy. Very All right. disturbing. All right,
I love that song, God Save the King, a Phil Pritchett classic.
Ah, indeed.
I think it was really clever. Just curious if there is a particular reason you wrote the song, or was it because some people still believe that Elvis Presley is alive?
Well, it's all those things, right, Kurt?
Basically, people in Kentucky, Tennessee, Arkansas, Alabama
that's
still
right.
believe he's
believe
alive.
Believe he is still alive. Those of us in the South, man. Still holding out hope.
Phil, why did you write God Save the King? I don't know the answer to this. As much as of an insider as I am, I've never heard you answer this question.
I don't know, man. I don't know. It just seemed like a good idea. We did play a show at the Aardvark in Fort Worth. I think it was called the Aardvark then. We played it. It's been called several names over the years. And, man, there was an opening band, one of those shows where we were laughing because the lead singer was a big dude with like a black pompadour, greasy hair thing, and some big old kind of yellow tinted glasses, moving his gear around. And I said, "Hey, man, it's Elvis." And Stalin Lynch started laughing, or whoever. Man, it might have been Mac before then, man, like the old band, the old Austin guys, Andrew Gerfers and Doug Holm and the like. Hey, man, look, it's Elvis or something. I don't know. It came from that. I wrote it in Nashville when I was living in Nashville. And, you know, I was trying to write something palatable maybe for someone to record. You know, I was...
I cut it.
Kurt South cut it. It worked. Oh, gosh.
How are those royalty checks?
Those royalty checks are just... They're just trickling in, man.
The studio,
penny at a time. I know it. Just all rolls my direction. Yeah, I wish there was a greater story. I wanted to just write something clear, something clever. I don't know.
See, I was hoping. I'd kind of been building this up in my head.
I'm sorry. That's a disappointing answer.
I was hoping.
I should let the song speak for itself and remain aloof.
I was hoping your answer would have been, man, I was trying to recreate Elvis's last minutes myself. It was in a bathrobe sitting on the toilet in my bathroom.
All right. God, why does this always go back to this with you? Always this dark humor.
Well, no,
black
I thought
humor.
Maybe you tried to go to a dark place
no, of
to
course
extract.
Not. It's just a fun, clever song. And I had that little, I can't remember what I was doing with the da 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 da. I remember that little, we talked about songwriting a couple podcasts ago. I couldn't remember how I played that intro. I listened to a demo years later, and I was going down, 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 da 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 down, which was kind of funny. It was different than the da 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 da. So I don't know. I didn't remember how I was originally doing it, but I think the way we do it now is better.
I agree.
And Stolly, when we were in the studio, he added just the big snare roll at the beginning. You know,
the now legendary snare roll.
Yeah. So that added a lot to it. The band brought a lot to that one. And I like it because it's short. when I'm playing it live. It's not long. We can we string out the jam there in the middle a little bit sometimes, but it's just a good short tune. I think that's why people grab onto it. It's just a simple idea, and it's really two verses. There's no big third verse where me and Elvis just go off into the sunset in a convertible or something to start our own band.
I don't know. I think that might have been a little more interesting.
Really? Maybe we'll have God Save the King 2 on the next Pritchett record.
All right, you ready for another question?
What do we got? Come on, what's next here? Well, thanks for that question there, Kat.
Here's another
mailbag.
Good one.
Reach in there, pull out another one, Kurt.
If you choose to record another artist's song,
this is for all you songwriters out there. I get this question a lot.
Do you have to purchase the song or just obtain permission to record it?
You know what I say? Record it. If it does well, they'll sue your ass. Then you can do the paperwork. Man, every lawyer in the world get on me for that.
Phil@philpritchett.com. Email him.
That's not totally true. I do think people – let me say this. I do think people at this level, whatever level we're on, Kurt, level one, making your first album, don't get – I'm not saying don't copyright or don't – yeah, jeez. But guys, bands can get really hung up on this kind of stuff and hire lawyers and copyright. Do I copyright it all together? Do I copyright it one song at a time? And they got forms and they're emailing publishers and sending checks to everybody. And man, I've paid royalties, but I the royalties are, you know, me sending Lowell George of the estate of Little Feet a few pennies every quarter or something. Or it's not, you're not dealing with the kind of money anyone's going to hunt you down for.
But you do have to obtain permission.
You do have to. Well, you just license the song.
Right. That's the permission, is you license it.
But can they say no? You can't record my song.
Yes, they can.
They can.
They can. And see, if you're covering
a song, we play a song live, maybe a petty song, putting it on our deal. Let us know where to send the check. Petty can say, you cannot put that on your album.
They can give you a cease and desist, yes.
Yeah, yeah.
But my attorney,
does anyone ever do that? I don't know.
My attorney pointed all this out to me a while back because I was trying to argue with him. Because
they
like,
all want the money. You have to send them a check for $40.
But he was like, look, I'm the attorney here. I'm telling you.
They cannot grant you a license.
They cannot grant you a license. Or if you do record it without licensing the song, they can send you a cease and desist.
Right.
Which means, say you've ordered 3,000 of those CDs with that song on
it.
You have to destroy those albums.
Yeah, that's right.
And all
that's
that.
Right.
So, yeah, go obtain permission and license it. It doesn't cost you much. If you start selling a ton of them, that's where BMI and ASCAP step in anyway.
Right.
They come in and they hand out the money to who gets it. But,
Harry Fox Agency.
Or Harry Fox.
Is really a...
They handle the license.
And you can handle I remember for Lucinda Williams, Locks. I found her on Harry Fox, and there was a form you fill out, a PDF online, and you send in a check for $60 or something like that for the first 1,000 records or whatever it is. What was it now? 8 cents a song?
It's almost $100 per 1,000.
Yeah, something like that. It's almost 10 cents
almost
a song.
Almost 10 cents a song.
So if you're selling, $100 for 1,000 records sold. Mm-hmm. It is very important to have your licensing, your copyrights, but don't get so hung up on it. That's why I always say to guys, man, cover a friend of your song or something where you can just buy them lunch.
Yeah.
That's always kind of fun to do, a good way to do it. One of my proudest moments was when we did I Shall Be Released, Bob Dylan. You literally have to contact Bob Dylan. There's a Bob Dylan music office in New York. Mm-hmm. And I got a letter back on Bob Dylan stationery saying to, send him a check for $81 or something. I was like, okay. We did that, secured that. So I got some Dylan stationery laying around
Dylan
here somewhere.
Dylan stationery.
I need to frame it, put it on the wall.
The second half of that question.
Prove that I've contributed to his fortune. Go ahead.
As far as playing it in a live setting.
Right, right.
That is up to the venue. Actually, the venues have to...
Well, they pay that's ASCAP and BMI
they
royalties.
They pay ASCAP, BMI, and CSAC royalties to cover any cover songs that are played in their venue.
Right, or even your songs.
Or even,
When, like, I don't know,
That's a jukebox Muzak that they're playing through house speakers.
Any a lot of people don't realize that ASCAP and BMI are performance societies, quote-unquote non-profit organizations. CSAC is for-profit. Mm-hmm. Those are the three performance rights organizations. They distribute money by looking at radio playlists, mm-hmm. looking at – they can go into a club with a jukebox and see what's on the jukebox. And they can say, hey, you've got Dylan on here, Phil Pritchard, and Kurt South. You need to pay us $400 a month. Mm-hmm. In fact, I mean, songwriters and publishers need to be paid. Radio's easier because you can base that on how big the station is, how much advertising revenue, right. and that's what it's gauged on. A lot of clubs complain that we play about ASCAP and BMI walking in their establishment and demanding money. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like the mafia or something.
Because
that's a hard thing to calculate. You kind of, man, we're just playing some satellite radio in here. Well, but you're playing this station. Thinking is, and correctly so, the reason people are staying in your bar and giving you money for drinks is because you're playing our artists mm-hmm. over the PA or through your jukebox.
Has nothing to do with the $2 you call it.
That's right. Or the same thing applies for a band. Hey, the reason people are in here drinking is because Phil Pritchard was playing here, and you also had the Drive-By Truckers and Walt Wilkins or something. So it's hard to put a value on that. So there's a lot of headbutting between clubs and performance rights. A lot of people don't realize that if there's just a radio playing in a restaurant, you owe someone money. The restaurant pays a performance society for that song mm-hmm. being played in there. Now, you know, they don't chase down every little lead, ASCAP.
Boy, they're Nazis, though.
Well, they are. Oh, they roll in. They do.
They roll in suits and flashing badges.
And the most expensive one is CSAC, I've heard. They demand the most money, which is interesting because they've got by far the smallest roster. ASCAP and BMI are giants. They got everybody. Yeah. CSAC's more of an independent. They said CSAC will roll in and want $1,000 for a month of playing. And then BMI will just say, man, just give us $200 or something. You know what I mean? It's just kind of like, man, BMI, the whole jukebox is BMI. You know, it's all country guys. I don't understand it. And the funny thing about ASCAP and BMI is if you have a big hit song and you get a check for $150,000 for your top 10 hit as the writer, there's no accounting attached. It's very you can't sue ASCAP. You can't sue BMI. That's in your contract with them. They are just – it's just, it's like, I don't know what it is. It's almost like a government agency or something.
Yeah, it almost is. It really is.
You can't sue them. You cannot file a complaint that you're not getting enough. It's very interesting. And quite honestly, man, I have not had much experience with it. I've never had some huge hit where there's a lot of money changing hands and showing up. And very confusing. Performance rights. Well, you got to fill out those forms, man. Dude, just cover your friend's songs or something. Don't mess too heavily with it. You're just going to end up getting sued if it works. Next question.
In conversation with people or just overhearing conversations, do you ever hear someone say something and think it would be a great line in a song?
A great line. That's a good question.
All the time.
For you? You hear like a little phrase or something like that?
Well, not so much as pulling an exact quote from someone, but I listen to people's conversations a lot.
You're out there eavesdropping on people?
Well, it's usually when
Isn't that Kurt standing in line behind us at the movie? Watch your mouth. Don't be talking about
I'm usually a party to the conversation.
Yeah?
Yeah, I take a lot of songs I've written have been based on someone else's troubles or
you know, it was a great remember that movie Slacker, Richard Linklater's mm-hmm. first big independent film, did it in Austin. It's just this hodgepodge cool movie, Slacker. Check it out. If you lived in Austin ever, it's particularly funny. But that was his deal. The script was pulled from overheard conversations. And, dude, it's hilarious. I mean, standing in a movie line in Austin to some dude behind you talking about how the Smurfs are actually it's the right wing, propaganda, or just what? Just some of the conversations are just like, man, you couldn't make this up, man. You just had to hear some dude behind you in the movie line He's going, yeah, man, that's why there's no girls that are Smurfs, man. You've got Papa Smurf. And, man, that's right. It's a society. It's sort of a right wing, but more of a commune, you know, of subversive entities. You know, just some dude. And that's what this whole movie is. And it just moves from one to the other. Very interesting.
I'm glad I don't live in Austin, by the way. Can I just
say
that?
It's a little out of your league, man. It's an acquired taste. It's an acquired taste. I don't know. Overheard conversations? I don't know. You know, kids say funny things. You know, sometimes they'll misspeak something or... I've used stuff like that. I'm trying to think of an example. I can't.
I love to use other people's just
copyrighted material.
I like to narrate other people's misery a little bit.
Yes. Well, you know, I had a lot of questions. There was the last song on my first album, Woman, was a divorce song. I mean, it was about a guy who's left his wife and they've split up. And I, you know, I was happily married, so it was hard. It was kind of a weird, but it came out really good. I had a friend who went through that, you know, and I kind of thought, man, what would be those real tangible things that you'd miss?
I do that a lot.
Like, man, when would you take off your wedding ring? When would you help her move out, or would you not be there when she was moving out? That'd be weird, man. What do you do with all the plates and stuff you got for your wedding?
I would burn.
Do you give
all
like five
stuff
to her and five to you? How does this work? And so these were the questions I was thinking about. I was like, man, how does he handle something like that? So that worked its way into the song. And like, how'd you write this very real divorce song? I was like, well, I was just looking at what I had and then writing about the opposite.
I'm going to write my version of that song where I'm just walking around shirtless with overalls on. Just
dude, that's a biographical depiction.
Watching her move out.
With binoculars across the street in a tree,
just working on my putting stroke while she's trying to carry a sofa, and just go, hey, that looked heavy. Maybe you shouldn't be leaving.
The Kurt South divorce song. I can see it now. Oh man, what else? What else we got? Is that all for the mailbag?
That is
God,
all.
That's a lot, man. All in one letter.
All in
amazing,
one.
Amazing, amazing.
Pretty
well,
good.
Kat, she's written in before, but it's great that we have these people around the country who always write in. You always have a little thought moving forward, you know.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Takes the pressure off of us coming up with stuff to talk about.
That is, man. Always coming up with stuff to talk about. Oh, I was distressed. Someone was talking about. I did get one from someone talking about Super Bowl halftime shows we've talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But are there any acts left? And the ticket was saying that the Black Eyed Peas were going to do it this year. Is that true, or they were just
I wouldn't be surprised.
Down.
They're
what a
the world's
down.
Biggest ass whip.
Golly.
And the thing is,
remember they've had a number one record forever. I'm just like, dude, hip hop and that kind of just dance crap, it just does not translate to a live setting.
If you just got a bunch of dancing up there,
I'm just kind of like, dude, it's like going
to
a Broadway show.
If you went to Jerry
show.
Jones' new stadium in Arlington
and
put up Black Eyed Peas, $20 playing, you wouldn't have 20,000 people show up.
You know what happened at the halftime show? The patron saint of the full band, Kevin Haggard, is taking me to some football games. Now, we were kind of hard on the pro football game experience, being out with the great unwashed at the games. Halftime, preseason, Houston Texans. I shit you not. They said, and now for halftime entertainment, we're going to set a jazzercise record. Did I tell you this?
What?
They trot out 1,000 middle-aged, some of them morbidly obese women in formation.
Easy, Phil.
100 yards. I'm just telling you what I saw as I drank my $12 beer. And they start playing some dunch, 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 and they all go into a routine, just doing punches and high leg kicks. I mean, it was a jazzercise.
Before a Texans game?
Yes. No, this was the halftime show. This was the halftime show. They were setting the most people ever doing jazzercise. And, dude, I looked at Blue, and we started laughing. It was the most ridiculous. I'm just like, you couldn't roll Reckless Kelly out here on a flatbed to play a couple of songs. They'd have done it, wouldn't they?
Yes, they would have done it.
What is this, man?
I mean, was Wade Bowen busy that day? Let's get some music out there.
And so I started thinking about the pro game suffers from this. Pro football. My brother brings up two great points. I go, man, but I like going to college football games. Why is that? He's like, there's two big reasons for it. One, he said, it's a better crowd. I'm like, but there's 100,000 people at a college games. He goes, ah, but they've all gone to college. I'm like, well, that's true. He goes, everybody's just in their slacks with their hat and their nice polo golf shirt. They're going to the A&M game or whatever. So he goes, generally speaking, that's probably true.
Yes.
You have that. Plus, during the game, you get the bands over there. You know, just doing that atmosphere. You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
college football, fall, atmosphere. You don't have the bands at the pro game. So the band gives you the atmosphere during the game. They march at halftime. Everybody stands up for the band. Great tradition. But the pros, you get jazzercise for halftime. And then you Black Eyed Peas at the Super Bowl, and then just the rocket, just a beat down during the game, just the blaring speakers, advertising. What a whip, man. The pro game, I'm telling you, it better be careful, because it's a freaking beating. College is awesome. The pro game.
You know, and that translates to basketball, too. Listen.
Oh, the Maverick game?
The Mavericks,
the worst.
Just humble Billy Hayes over there being just a jerk off. And then you've got those dudes out there who just look like John Goodman, just sweating and wearing half shirts, dancing everywhere. The Mavs.
Oh, that's the other thing. All the cheerleaders and stuff. All the cheerleaders and stuff, dude. They just got the Britney Spears costumes. The pro game, there's this trashy element to it.
Well, have you ever
watched Dallas Cowboy cheerleaders? You know, I mean, yeah, they got cute cheerleaders in the Longhorns. They're college girls. I mean, there's nothing risque about the whole thing. You're just like, man, it's college football. The pro deal is so. Why do they think trashy. It has to be like that? It's going to a strip club mixed with WWF or something.
Have you ever watched the Dallas Cowboys cheerleaders reality show that they have on?
Oh, gosh, no.
Oh, my God.
I mean, is it just...
It is like... I mean, it's like a camera got loose in a whorehouse. I mean...
Watch yourself.
No,
Good grief.
I hope some of them are listening. Really. I mean, it's the biggest beatdown. It really is. It is amazing. I think your brother's that's sage.
That's pretty perceptive. You got traffic going to the Texas OU game. You got traffic. You got to walk a long way. It's kind of expensive, but dude, the whole atmosphere is completely different. It really is. It's just so anyway. I don't know how that. Where'd we get up?
Just
on that?
A bunch of cocaine and Prozac addled trollops.
Oh man. You know, I played it. Oh, gosh, I can't even go into this on
the
air.
Do it. Go into it. Let's hear it. Let's keep it real, Phil.
Well, I texted you a couple of times. I played at the House of Blues.
This is good
in
stuff.
In the restaurant the other night. Hey, it's the House of Blues, man. Play an acoustic show in the restaurant. It was worth the shot. I didn't know anything about it. You know, I didn't have anything to do. I'm like, sure. Well, man, we got a... You're in the House of Blues in Dallas. And... and we played the House of Blues. We opened for Cowboy Mouth there not too long ago. Big show, great room, you know, very, very cool. But it's a very huge corporate deal. It's all the
it's owned by Live Nation.
By Live Nation. Yeah. And so there's a lot of rules. Dude, first thing I pull up there and I just get dog cussed by the parking guy. He wants $15. I'm like, dude, I'm the band. I'm trying to load in. This guy he just unleashes on me. The problem was he had Collective Soul playing in the main room. You remember Collective Soul.
Yeah.
So they've just sold it out. Apparently there's 1,800 people who can't wait to go pay $40 to see Collective Soul. That was pretty shocking. Pretty impressive. Well, where's Phil playing? He's playing in the restaurant, which is like playing in Chili's, you know, next door. So I get there. I immediately see that this is probably a big mistake. That I should have just held out to play the main room with somebody else. I'm just like, oh, what am I doing here? It's a Wednesday night. You know, so I load in there. Man, it was just a scene, though, dude. I texted you a few times. Dude, the amount of guys at that show. I mean, every single guy was just guys you don't see in a lot of other cities in Texas or this country. Yes. They're huge, man. They're all like, they've been working out. Everybody in Dallas just is going to the gym or something. The tight shirts with the huge affliction, like, you know what I mean? And then they're all tattoos on the back of their neck, but they look like they could be a lawyer, you know, or something.
Yeah.
Dude, it was just...
It's called douchebaggery, Phil.
Yeah, that's what you said.
It's a familiar affliction.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, I was just like, it wasn't my crap. I was just like, man, you know, I just felt weird about asking people to come out to this deal. There was nowhere to park. It was expensive. It was kind of like going to the Cowboy football game or something and asking to come watch me play. I'm just like, dude, just put me at 8 airs or something. I was just like, wait, what am I?
Were there guys in the corner just bench pressing, getting one last rep before they walked in?
Yeah, dude, just like just in the bathroom doing push-ups just to get their veins kind of standing up before they come out of the bathroom. Oh, my gosh. It was just...
What goes so wrong? Boy. What's happened to society?
I don't know.
That's the question.
I don't know.
Again,
everywhere I go where I don't want to be, I'm like, I don't want to be at this game or I don't want to be here. Everyone in the world wants to be there. And it's not that I don't like being around people. But what's wrong with me? There's the real world out there, South, and I fear I'm not part of it. Are you part of it?
No.
No? What do? You just sit in your house with your pride?
You notice how rarely I leave my house.
What, are you proud of that?
Yeah. I love it.
No.
I absolutely love it. I really do. I could not leave my property, the Palatial South Compound, for a week and not feel like I'm missing a damn thing.
Is that like David Koresh or something?
I do stockpile weapons.
Yeah, yes, stockpile weapons.
There are weapons.
Like, you're kind of like the Branch Davidians or something.
A little
bit.
You're
starting
bit.
To scare me. You're starting to scare bit. Me. This segment is over.
Nobody
this segment is
nobody
over.
Screws with us.
You scare me anyway. You always creep me out coming in here with some of the things you say. Well, that's been some email, some mailbag stuff. Well, coming up here in the vault, the vaunted vault, we're going to talk about little Johnny Cougar Mellencamp. How tall is John Mellencamp? 4'11"? 5 feet?
5'2".
5'2". Johnny Cougar coming up next.
Thinks he's 6'6".
Folks, we're talking about Scarecrow, man's Roman's countryman. Lend me your ears. Phil Pritchard here on the P2 Podcast. Email me, phil@philpritchard.com, with your questions and requests on the podcast. And also, what? Kurt South is dying laughing. He's holding up a vinyl copy of John Mellencamp's landmark album, Scarecrow, pointing at the cover and laughing hysterically. We're getting into the vault here. What's going on, Kurt?
Well, I just love this. This is 1985, right. Year of Our Lord.
Yeah.
Mellencamp is leaning on a fence post.
Was he the first to do that?
Just out in the middle of a field in southern Indiana,
mm-hmm.
wearing a very 1980s denim jacket, buttoned all the way to the top.
Yes.
Collar flipped up.
Yep.
Complete with the bolo string tie.
Oh,
does he have
the bolo
jacket.
String tie?
Look
I can't see. Oh, I see it. Yes, yes, yes. Interestingly, years later, you had a Garth Brooks album.
Yes.
Black and white photo.
Yes.
Leaning on a fence post, looking off in the distance. And the title of the record? Scarecrow.
It was called Scarecrow? Garth,
yes. I remember just going, dude, did no one say, hey, dude, could we call it something else? And I mean, it was like the exact picture, just Brooks leaning on this post. I think it was his last record Garth ever made for Capitol before his, quote, retirement. Anyway, man, Johnny Cougar. Where are you on Johnny Cougar, South? He burst onto the scene, of course, Johnny Cougar.
Yeah.
You look at those old videos, Jack and Diane and Hurts So Good. He was John Cougar.
Just wearing penny loafers and black jeans.
A muscle T-shirt.
Muscle shirt. I think I think Mellencamp... Just him and his image,
yeah,
can be annoying and cheesy, as is anyone's can be. But man, the dude's written some great songs.
Man, he does.
Hey, he was Americana before the term was even out there. Just equal parts country rock, soul, whatever.
Oh, no question.
He took the roots of American music.
He had just as big a hits in the '80s as all these. As the
no
Flock
doubt.
Of Seagulls and Depeche Mode or whoever
yeah.
we had going on.
Yeah, more
you had Mellencamp just doing Jack and Diane. You know, of course, Scarecrow,
Small
Pink,
Town,
Pink Houses.
Yeah.
What else is on that one? Small Town on that one?
Yeah, Small Town's on here. Rain on the Scarecrow, Menace to Memory, Small Town, Lonely Old Night.
It's a Lonely Old Night.
R-O-C-K in the USA.
Yeah. Cities and they come from the smaller towns.
But I think I will say this. A lot of what Texas country is and a lot of the red dirt stuff, it draws heavily, heavily from Mellencamp.
Because you take like a singer-songwriter, rocker-type guy, like a Springsteen or something.
Steve Earle.
But, man, you come from Texas, where these guys are coming from. They would do well. And, man, I tell you what, man, I haven't heard a young band with a song as good as, like, Pink Houses or Small Town. I mean, it's so simple, man.
Yeah.
It's kind of the Tom Petty, it's just three chords and some good sentiment. He had great bands.
Kenny Aronoff, on the drums,
one of the all-time great drummers.
Mike Wanchick, a great guitar player, still with him too. Those guys have been with him for years.
Now he had David Grissom, the great guitar player.
For a while, yeah.
David Grissom
joined him in like 1991.
Like around the Paper and Fire, the Lonesome Jubilee era, wasn't he with him then?
And with Cherry Bomb and Check It Out.
Did I ever tell you that songs. I played golf with David Grissom one time? The great guitar player with John Mellencamp. I was living in Austin and producing a project with Spencer Starnes, the great producer down there. Spencer was an avid golfer, chain smoker, and just a hilarious guy. So he takes me and David Grissom. I was all excited because I know Grissom played with Mellencamp. He left Mellencamp to play with Joe Ely, left Ely to go play with Mellencamp. Then he came back and formed the band Storyville. Remember them?
Yes.
Austin?
Oh, yeah. Malford I've got all
Milligan,
the records.
Malford Milligan and Stevie Ray's old rhythm section, Double
Trouble.
It's a
good day. It's a good day for the blues.
Yeah.
Yeah. Malford just moved back to Milwaukee, by the way.
Did he really?
He did.
Malford Milligan.
One of the best
great
vocals.
Singers.
Yeah.
So, man, Grissom's there. So, I'm a big Mellencamp fan. So I tried to BS with the guy. I kid you not, man. I was trying to. He was very quiet, real nice guy, great guitar player, very serious about his golf game, and I don't know, I had a couple beers or something. But so like on the 10th hole, he just dumps one in the water. He just puts his head down. I just lean my head back. I just go, it's so good. Come on, baby, like it hurt. He just kind of glares at me over there. I'm just like, eh, hey, come on, you know.
You didn't do
yes,
that.
Yes, I did
you?
Too. Yes, I did. Spencer thought it was funny. Grissom, not so. Just picks up his bag, walks down the fairway. I was like, man, what's it like working with John Mellencamp, man? Well, we kind of been talking a little bit, you know. I mean, I wasn't
surprised he didn't hit you with his 9-iron.
No, no. I had a couple other ones. I can't remember.
Get a few beers and fill. That's what you get out of.
Yeah, just some
masterful
quips
like
game.
That.
Of course, I was 4 under par at the time, so I didn't think you liked that either.
That's why I hated you.
You know, yeah. I just drained an 18-footer for birdie on the last hole. But Mellencamp, I liked reading when early in his career, he went on tour with like the Kinks.
Yeah.
He went on tour with like Aerosmith or something. Mm-hmm. And he got kicked off of all those tours because he was such a jackass. He'd get out there, he'd play too long, he'd run out in the crowd with his guitar, and he'd kick stuff off the stage, and just he'd go, I got kicked off of all those tours. Notoriously a tough guy to get along with, Mellencamp. Kind of got small man's disease. That's what some people say. Yeah, I mean, he's a small guy, kind of pugilistic.
He's a little asshole.
Yeah, kind of. But he's very well known in the Midwest, very revered. Indiana.
Yeah, he's from Southern Indiana, just raised on a farm.
And is a painter. Isn't he a big painter?
Yeah,
I knew a guy in the art scene
out of
Austin. My friend Bodie Hedgecock would tour the Midwest with paintings, and Mellencamp frequently had stuff displayed, and he said, man, everybody knows Johnny. Everybody talks about Johnny.
Hyper-intelligent guy. I mean, you listen to him talk. I mean, he's extremely well-read, very, very, really, he's a very dynamic character, no doubt.
I'll tell you what, though, man, I got a free ticket to go see him in Austin about 90, maybe like late 90s, friend of mine.
Best show you've ever
Irwin
seen.
Center. Worst show I ever saw.
What?
Worst show I ever saw.
Why?
Man, he looked like he just didn't care, man. Maybe he did. He saunters out. He runs through the hits, hour and 10 minutes. I mean, he didn't even sing his songs. He just kind of held it up. He just had one hand on his hip, cigarette in one hand, and just held it up while the crowd sang Jack and Diane. Never said thank you. Never said, hey, it's good to be back in Austin. Hour and 10 minutes. guitar down, off the stage, never saw him again. Didn't say one thing to the crowd. It was pretty cold. Maybe he's had an off night, because I know he's got a reputation. You know, I've always seen his videos and see, I go, man, he's just some live juggernaut. I was pretty surprised, man. I was a little let down. It was shocking.
Can't be on all the
pretty
time,
lame.
I guess.
He had an off night, maybe.
Yeah.
You know, he started Farm Aid.
Yes, he did.
With Willie and Neil Young and co.
He did.
Inspired by Bob Dylan, our good friend Dylan, who pissed everybody off at Live Aid, the big fundraiser in 1984 or 5. When was Live Aid?
It was 84.
Raising money for starvation in Africa.
Mm-hmm.
The Bob Geldof, Boomtown Rats-led, charity drive. And Dylan got on stage, and the only thing he said to the crowd was, hey, I hope we can just raise some money for the farmers. They're really hurting or something. It made a lot of people upset that he wouldn't talk about the issue at hand, which was Africa. He's talking about the farmers. What was he talking about?
Yeah.
Just showed that he was very disconnected from what this was all about or something. But it did inspire other guys. Like, yeah, why don't we do something for the farmers? What's the deal? So, you know, you can thank Dylan and his whatever, just being out of it. You can thank him for Farm Aid. Mellencamp, always championing the cause of the farmer, the Midwest.
The union.
There's really nobody out there in the Midwest like him. I mean, he's kind of like, Springsteen's very national, but identified with New Jersey, New York, Springsteen,
yeah,
the
definitely.
East. Mellencamp, the heartland, baby.
Yeah, he is, man. He's... It's funny because in the context of popular rock and roll back in the 80s and 90s, he was just looked upon as a hillbilly, man.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You know, but that's where, you know, now alt country and Americana and country rock and all that, these terms are thrown around all the time. Like, dude, Mellencamp was doing that almost 30 years ago.
Oh, man, yeah.
Before anyone ever knew what it was. And, you know, I listened to, I remember when I first started playing in a band and getting stuff going. I had more people remark that it reminds me of Mellencamp. And I never thought
about wasn't a
that.
Lot of, there wasn't a lot of guys with a good growly voice and just banging on acoustic guitar.
Yeah.
I mean, you just didn't
and
see
never,
it a whole
I
lot.
And I never thought consciously that, man, Mellencamp is an influence on me. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I start playing out live. People are like, man, really, you know, it was always for older people, you
right.
know. Say, man, you really remind us of Mellencamp. And at first I was like, it's not cool. But
yeah.
The more I thought about it and the more I went back and revisited those old records, I thought, man, half the time I was listening to Mellencamp.
That's right.
You know, I mean.
And, man, he's one of those guys, even at that show, you know.
He's ubiquitous.
Ubiquitous hits. I mean, he played an hour and 10 minutes, and, man, you knew the words to every song, man. I mean, really, for me, more so than almost more so than like Tom Petty or Springsteen. I mean, people talk about those two guys a lot in Texas music. Man, we're roots rock, man. Song of Rye Rock. We like Springsteen and Petty. They rarely mention Mellencamp, but boy, you look at some of his songs. You know, Small Town, Scarecrow, Rain on the Scarecrow.
Rain on the Scarecrow.
Jack and Diane, R.O.C.K. and the USA,
awesome.
The Authority song. And the Wilds Come Tumbling Down. Dude, he's got as many as those other guys, man.
You know what? This just popped in my head.
Just
talking about the Mellencamp influence on the Texas Red Dirt thing.
Yeah, exactly.
I remember 2001. It was September 13th, I believe.
A day that will live in infamy,
Two days after September
11th. Oh, okay.
It was a Thursday night. Yeah. The Aardvark, Cross-Canadian Ragweed.
Is that right?
I go to that show. They walk out on stage. And a lot of people were thinking the show might be canceled.
Right.
Show went on, sold out, just line up and down Berry Street to get in. First song Ragweed does, they get on stage, that they think would be appropriate, seeing as what happened 48 hours earlier, was Little Pink Houses.
Is that right?
And it was, I tell you, it was profound.
Yeah.
It was
black
awesome.
Man.
I'll always remember that.
Black.
You know?
Huh, I've never heard that story.
Yeah, they come out, they just come out
ain't
and just start playing Little Pink Houses. But man, as far as a guy who just has always been himself and always just...
Oh, always sticking it to the man or to the labels.
Always, man. And I tell you, Rain on the Scarecrow is one of the best songs that just talks... You know, all these country rock guys, they all talk about growing up in small towns, rural, to the point that it's all become rote.
Yeah.
Friday night football games. Rain on the Scarecrow is poetry, man.
It really is.
Man,
it really is.
The lyrics to that going, okay, now that's a dude putting a spin on the rural life that I've never heard before.
Yeah, just rocking it out.
It's just a powerful song. Awesome
that's
stuff.
Scarecrow in the Rain. Great vocal guy, man. Just
yeah,
a lot
great
of range,
delivery.
A lot of power, great yeah. delivery.
Yeah.
And
rocks as hard as a lot of those real hard rockings, but he does it with substance and
yeah,
has always
integrity.
Done it with his style, you know.
So were you a little worried when he did the truck commercial? You know, did you lose
no,
a little
I
for him? Not too much?
Because
he took a lot of flack for that.
He took a lot of flack, but look, I'm so, just this is just me talking.
This is in reference to the Ford truck. Was it Ford?
It was
or
Chevy.
Chevy truck, yeah, yeah.
I think it was Chevy.
What was the song? Oh, it was recent.
This is our country.
Oh, this is our yeah. country.
But
a good melon camp.
I mean,
so,
going back to what we talked about in the first segment, everybody's selling out. That look.
Selling it up the chain, yeah. He's got to retire, too, right?
It's rock and roll, man. It's not art. They're just good songs.
Yeah, that's right.
And
yeah.
if somebody wants to use them to sell something, let them.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, you get to make the
call. I honestly have a hard time with singers and songwriters being called artists.
Yeah.
I think that's a little heady.
They're performers.
It's a little presumptuous. You know, man, I'm an artist. Man, you know, you get up there and you make up songs and you sing about shit that, it's so what?
Yeah.
Sell it. If somebody offers you, sell it. That didn't mean it's not sacred or isn't great. It's just rock and roll.
It's just money. I don't know. I mean,
from,
it helps
from
you
the,
out for a little while.
From day one, rock and roll has been for sale. And just go with it. Go play golf and enjoy it. Who cares?
Selling out. Listen to this.
Well, if you start making music and you have no intention of offering it as a commercial product, never let it leave your room. Don't try to play a gig in public. Don't put out any records. Just keep it to yourself.
That's right. Like you do, just stay in your house.
Just stay in your house. But if you, but you know, I Steve Earle did the same thing. He did Chevy truck commercials. The revolution starts now. And
yeah.
Caught all this flack, and you know, and Steve. It's funny because Steve Earle is an avowed communist.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Big left wing social guy, but he didn't have a hard time taking a big corporate check.
Uh-huh.
You know, so if you don't look at music and rock and roll as this sacred cow not to be touched, then you won't ever get caught in the wheels of hypocrisy. But
there
if,
you go.
You know, just it's for sale. Everything's for sale. So what?
I hear
Write
you, man.
Me a check. River right. City Blues. I'll take whoever's offering the most.
Yeah.
Can have it.
Highest bidder can have all the copyrights on River City Blues. You know. Let the bidding start at $40.
Let it start now.
Let it start at $40. Well, man, that has been our episode here. Kurt South has been here just shooting off opinions like sparks flying out from underneath a car dragging a muffler.
Damn right.
Just in every direction. Some fires ensue in the medians. Thanks for being here, Kurt.
Thanks for having me.
You bet, man. Talking some Johnny Cougar Mellencamp.
Go listen to Mellencamp. It'll change your life.
That's right.
You'll remember what was
You'll
great.
You'll remember why you play the guitar and sing and feel
right.
stuff. Well, that is our show for this week, folks. Email us, phil@philippritchard.com, or call me. Book the band. Book the studio. 817-733-5256. For Kurt South, I am Phil Pritchard, signing off on the P2 Podcast. Be good to each other out there. See you next week. It's a long